Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay, and bringing you the news behind the news, the story behind the story. Hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at, illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality, not illusion or delusion, that's going to determine what the future will bring. And I have to remind you, the views that are expressed here are not necessarily those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of the station you're listening to. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And if you would like to give us a call, our numbers are 1-888-24-LIBERTY. That's 1-888-24-LIBERTY. Or here in the Central Coast of California at 464-8295. But please hold your calls for the time being, because we have with us on the line Mr. I.C. Smith, and we're going to be talking about his book, Inside, A Top G-Man Exposes Spies, Lies, and Bureaucratic Bungling Inside the FBI, by a gentleman who was a former special agent in charge and who served with distinction in the FBI for many years. Mr. Smith, thank you so much for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure, and greetings from the Middle Peninsula of Virginia.
All right, fine. Well, of course, your is a very, very candid book, and I realize, of course, that it had to be gone over by the FBI, and I was surprised the CIA wanted to go over it, too. And yet, of course, in many respects, you're quite critical of some of the things you've seen in your years with the FBI, although you still love the organization, don't you?
Oh, without question. I have this great appreciation and even a debt of gratitude for the FBI that provided me with experiences that I certainly would have never dreamed of growing up very modestly in North Louisiana that I would have ever experienced.
And, of course, you were in the Navy, served submarines, served on all sorts of ships in the Navy, and then you come back and you join the FBI, and of course, you start out just at, sort of at the bottom, and you had a lot of fascinating experiences. One of them was with a Chinese agent. I'd never even heard of him before, named Mr. Chin, who was actually infiltrated, I think, what was the CIA, wasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Larry Wu Tai Chin. He was basically a three-decade employee of the CIA, and during that whole three decades, he was working for Chinese intelligence.
And of course, the CIA really didn't want to admit that. In fact, they wouldn't even tell you about him for a long time.
Well, initially, when I received the information, it was just a very few lines on a piece of paper, no identity of anything, but it was very sketchy information from a source who said that there was someone who was providing secrets.
And, of course, this was basically a Chinese infiltrator, wasn't it? Did you call him Mr. Plainsman, or what was that?
Well, yes. One of the 75 or so new revelations in the book is that you find, and one of them is, of course, the code name of this source, the code name that I provided him, is Plainsman, and that's taken from a submarine. Terminology as Plainesman, and all of the code names that I used during that time was actually taken from submarines.
And of course, this was a man who was really very trusted. He was an interpreter. He'd been with the CIA for 30 years. But, you know, the thing that really bothered me, and here is a man who is a womanizer, he was a gambler. Why would you have anybody who obviously has real problems with his morality, allowed to continue working at our intelligence service? What we do, you know, morals have consequences. If you have a man who's going to cheat on his wife, why wouldn't you think he was going to cheat on the government?
Well, that's one of those great mysteries, and one of the things that I was never able to fully resolve, and one of the reasons, of course, that we were never able to really determine everything we needed to know about someone like Larry Chin is the fact that he committed suicide shortly after he was convicted of espionage.
But, of course, you were instrumental in getting him convicted. Weren't you sort of in charge, Aegis, there for a time?
Yes, what happened is that I was the supervisor in the Washington field office when we received this information. It was without a name. And
hold that thought right there, and we'll be back in just a moment as we bring some of our other stations on board and lose some stations temporarily. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and with us this afternoon is Mr. I.C. Smith, and we're going to be talking about his fascinating book, Inside, A top G-man exposes spies, lies, and bureaucratic bungling inside the FBI. And I think that this is a very objective book by somebody within the FBI. He was a former special agent in charge. And, of course, he tells about his years in the FBI and of course, many of the experiences he had. We were starting to talk about a Mr. Chin, who was actually a Soviet agent who'd worked for 30 years for the CIA. And the CIA suspected they had somebody there, but they had no idea who it was. And so why don't you sort of pick this story up from there?
Yes, it was the Chinese. We had this source that was able to providing just very sketchy information, and that there was a penetration within the intelligence service. Initially, actually, the CIA tried to finger the FBI as being probably the source, but that wasn't the case. And after just a short few weeks, we were able to determined that it was Larry Wu Tai Chin who was almost certainly the spy that had been working for the Chinese basically his whole 30-year career. He had originally gone to work for the Chinese, for the United States Army, actually during World War II. And then later on, when he actually reached some accommodation with the Chinese Intelligence Service, and you got to remember this was actually before the communist takeover of China, when he actually had reached some sort of accommodation with the communists.
And, of course, if he'd ever had any idea what was coming up, he would have gotten away from you. But you managed, of course, to hold off arresting him until you really had a pretty ironclad case against him. How long did it take you really to track him down and identify him and watch him and then get the goods on him?
Well, it was actually just a very short few weeks from the time that I received that very sketchy piece of information until he was identified. But the big problem that you have in this sort of investigation is that we still had a source who was inside China, and we could not do anything that would jeopardize the safety and the security of that source. You know, it certainly in those days, and probably not so much today, is that the sources are just, they're sacred, and you go to great lengths to maintain the confidentiality of those relationships, and in this case, keeping him alive.
And of course, how long did it take you then before you actually closed in and arrested Mr. Chin, Larry Chin?
Oh, I think it's probably about 4 years.
All right, fine. Well, we're going to be back here in just a moment after our other stations join us, but we'll get a little bit more into the background of this amazing, amazing spy case. Well, Dr. Stan here, and we're talking about Larry Chin, who was an interpreter working for the CIA, and for 30 years he was betraying information to the Chinese communists. But the amazing thing, he was taking all these trips to communist China, and you would think that somebody might have been suspicious that a Chinese was making recurrent trips to communist China, who was cheating on his wife, who was a gambler, somebody would have been suspicious of him. You should be able to hold people to moral standards, and they're going to cheat on their wife. Why would you think they wouldn't cheat on the government?
Well, this is one of those things that, one of the things that happened to him, of course, is that he was actually polygraphed by the CIA. And one of the things I talk about in the book is that when I confronted the CIA, and I was a rather junior FBI officer at the time, and I was confronted him. I said, well, tell me about the polygraph of him. And then a young polygrapher for the CIA spoke up, and he said, and I never will forget this. He said, under present-day quality control, we would have determined that probably something was wrong with that polygraph. And so I immediately said, wait, are you trying to tell me that you've gone back and looked at these tests, and now you think that perhaps there was indication that he may have shown deception or something like that? Well, immediately the CIA lawyers intervened and wouldn't let him answer that question. So I went back to FBI headquarters and basically sent them a secure teletype asking for them to explain this situation. And they came back and basically said something to the effect that, well, they now concluded that maybe the sensors attached to the to Chin for the when he'd given the polygraph weren't attached properly or something like that. Well, to me, that was just as damning as the fact that now that they were admitting that maybe he had given an improperly conducted polygraph is the fact that they had perhaps shown. deception. Frankly, I don't know the answer. I never did see the polygraph results.
Well, of course, the one thing to bring out is this man was responsible for the deaths of an awful lot of your agents in China. He had access to all sorts of information he never should have. And, of course, after 30 years, you got him. But in the meantime, of course, this man had done terrible damage as far as the security of the United States was concerned. Would that be a fair statement?
Oh, without question. One of the things that he was doing, for example, is that during the Korean War, is that he was helping interpret and debrief Chinese prisoners of war. You remember the Chinese intervened in the Korean War, and some of these people agreed to cooperate with the United States or the UN, and they were being infiltrated back into China. And of course, these people were continually being rolled up. You know, they'd lose, and we found out later, of course, that Chen was providing the identity of those individuals to his Chinese masters.
Well, now, of course, there were a number of other points that you, fascinating things that you cover in the book. And, of course, one of the things is that you pointed out that the Cubans, and you were working with some of the Cubans actually didn't trust the CIA. They trusted the FBI, but they did not trust the CIA.
Well, this is is one of those things that has never been revealed before, is that, and it's one of the things that when I went through the pre-publication review process, it took quite some effort to get it done. But this was actually quite a fascinating story, and there again, it's probably an example of where we had an opportunity to do something that really wasn't followed through, and then perhaps in this case, even politics intervened. But it was a strange sensation for me to be sitting on my office in Miami, Florida, and talking on the telephone with a Cuban intelligence officer in Havana.
And of course, this was basically the head of the Cuban DCI. What's that sort of like, the CIA?
Oh, yes. The fellow that I was dealing with he was a colonel in kind of the palace guard, you might say, of Fidel Castro. His name was Antonio de la Guardia. It was kind of interesting about him is in later years, he was actually put for a firing squad with General Ochoa by Castro.
But my feeling of reading your book was that he really wanted to defect, and you wanted to have he wanted to have a meeting with you. He wanted to have a meeting in Washington, D.C., and the FBI wouldn't allow that. Here was a guy that wanted to defect. I mean, he had all the secrets of Fidel Castro, and they wouldn't let him defect?
Well, this is kind of a fascinating thing of this. We, according to the two people that I refer to as Roberto and Fernando in the book, and that's not their real names, is that they were absolutely convinced that he was laying the groundwork for a defection. But you got to remember that at the time that I was having these indirect contacts with him, is that this was being done with the full knowledge of not only the head of the intelligence service at the time, Herman Barrios, but also the Abrantes, who is the Minister of Interior, which would be kind of like a cabinet member, and Fidel himself. And when this meeting that we were finally supposed to be held in Madrid, and it was canceled within, you know, just a matter of 36 hours or so before we would get underway. One of the things, these guys came back, and they were very disappointed, Fernando and Roberto were, and they said that when I had finally made contact with De La Guardia and told him that I hated to use the language because I'm not that sort of person, but kind of a diplomatic language, it's not convenient that I travel at the time, is that, Barrios erupted in anger, and then but said Fidel turned to him and he says, "Well, this Mr. Smith lying to us." And one of them told him, "No, I think he probably got caught up in the politics," and he just kind of turned and he said, "Well, I can understand that," and walked out.
And of course, you were trying to establish indirect contact with Fidel Castro to open up relationships between their country and our country, and there were obviously people in Washington, D.C. who had no intention of doing that.
Well, I think that, of course, this is, you got to remember, this was occurring at the end of the second term of President Reagan, and Vice President Bush was was trying to run for the presidency and everything, and he was actually, they hadn't just kind of conceded that he would be the nominee. As you recall, I think Pat Robertson was running against him, and also Senator Bob Dole.
And Jack Kemp, right.
That's right. And this was getting a pretty nasty campaign. And one of the, when I asked the people who called me, and he says this trip had been canceled, I said, well, why is it being canceled? And they said, because the Bush people on the NSC heard about it, and they canceled it. Now, I want to make very clear that I'm not, he didn't tell me that Vice President Bush knew this. They said the Bush people on the National Security Council.
And so we could have had some of accommodation with Fidel Castro and might have made life a lot easier for the people down there, but they cut off your contacts, and you had a unique opportunity to do this because they trusted you, and they did not trust the Central Intelligence Agency. And I think that's very important, and I've heard this from many other people who have been involved with the anti-communist movement in Cuba. They did never trusted the Central Intelligence Agency.
Well, you got to remember, too, at the time, the CIA was not in a position to object to my contacts with them because the Cuban government had just run a series of videos where they had showed how completely compromised CIA operations were inside of Cuba. You know, they had pictures of the, it was wonderful from a technical standpoint, in color and great sound. You could hear birds chirping in the background and all this. At the same time, you had CIA guys, scratching around out in the grass trying to find their drop sites and, you know, stuff like this. And they had, and according to the Cubans, they had completely compromised CIA operations inside of Cuba. And basically, CIA admitted that.
In other words, the CIA was totally compromised. How could you run a spy operation that poorly, unintentionally?
Well, you know, there again is one of those things that, sometimes happen in the government, is that there is the indicator, you look, you say, my gosh, we have these great successes, and they take them on face value because everybody wins if you're having successes, and they really, really, deep down, don't want to know that maybe these things aren't succeeding as well as they are.
Well, of course, you're very, very objective, and I know that your book had to go through censorship by the FBI and the CIA, so I think that you had perhaps be a little careful in what you wrote, but you were really very objective in your criticism of what happened at Ruby Ridge, where in violation of all of the rules of the FBI. Sure. The man in charge gave a shoot-to-kill order, and what was so disturbing, they killed Ruby, Randy Weaver's wife, and they wounded this other boy, and nobody was ever punished for violating every sense of right and rule. These people were not a danger to anybody. The whole idea of hostage crisis management is not to kill people, and Mr. Rogers, who was in charge, gave an order, shoot to kill, and he would have had them all killed if Colonel Bo Greitz hadn't got in there and negotiated their release.
Well, you know, and it's, of course, as much as J. Edgar Hoover has been demonized, is one of the things, in fact, I quote him in the book where he talks about, is that FBI only shoots to, you know, in self-defense or to protect someone else type thing. And that was the standard by which I had gone to training school, and I'd been a police officer, and we basically applied that same standard. Is that it wasn't a preemptive type of shooting, you might say, and I was just absolutely astounded when I first heard the story that they had this kind of a protracted shoot to kill of orders. That was just ran against the grain of everything that I had learned as a law enforcement officer, and even in particular the FBI.
But of course, what really bothers me about the whole story is that then they have their internal investigation. They find nobody's at fault. Nobody's ever punished. Nobody's ever let go. I think that a couple of people were, maybe weren't promoted or something. But nobody is responsible. Randy Weaver's wife is dead. The other boy is wounded. They take Randy Weaver to trial because they want to send him to jail forever. And the jury exonerates him for most of the things, of one minor thing. He's let out, and they even give him $300,000 for killing his wife. But nobody in the FBI is ever held responsible. We'll be back in just a moment here with Mr. I.G. Smith. It's a fascinating book.
Well, if there's any one tape that you should hear, it's my talk on geopolitics, an untold story that is vitally important if America is to survive as a free nation. It goes into the background of the forces that have created the wars of the 20th century, the Boer War, the First World War, the Second World War, Korea, Vietnam. We go into the ideological and the spiritual battle behind the forces that have moved America from crisis to crisis and are currently undermining the very fabric of our society. That number again, 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, and the tape, Geopolitics. It is vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WAR for copies of my talk on geopolitics.
This is health journalist Bill Sardi. In November of 1991, the 60 Minutes television show first reported on the French paradox, the fact the French violate every dietary rule for good health, eat a diet rich in fats and calories, and yet exhibit far better cardiovascular health than North Americans. Over a decade later, we know that molecules called polyphenols are responsible for the health benefits in red wine, but those molecules only remain stable in a sealed bottle of red wine. Longevinix is the first dietary supplement to stabilize red wine molecules in a sealed capsule, just like a corked bottle of red wine, providing red wine polyphenols without the calories, alcohol, and sulfite preservatives. One Longevinix capsule is equivalent in polyphenols to drinking 5 glasses of red wine. Call 866-405-4000 today to order Longevinix. It's a revolutionary dietary supplement. 866-405-4000.
Hi, this is Dr. Tony Teary. Are you one of the many people who take vitamin supplements? Do you take handfuls of pills each day to increase energy, reduce your pain, or improve your overall health? Now there is a better way to get the vitamins and minerals your body needs in a delicious-tasting whole food liquid supplement, Body Balance. Body Balance contains 121 essential vitamins and minerals and is made from only organic and natural sources. Developed by doctors, Body Balance was originally available only through healthcare professionals. Now this incredible whole food liquid supplement can be delivered directly to your home. Body Balance offers an extremely effective method to feed your body towards wellness, and we're confident you'll love the difference your body feels. To order your Body Balance, call me directly at 1-800-768-9763 and try it risk-free for 45 days. Again, that's 1-800-768-9763. Or online at healthyfoundations.net.
Hi, this is Joyce Riley, and most of you now know why so many people agree that Miracle 2 soap really is a miracle. Miracle 2 products are now being used by farmers and ranchers to increase their yield. Mechanics and machinists use it in their shops. Chiropractors and physicians are using Miracle 2, and the uses are simply too numerous to mention. Dr. Stan and the folks at Radio Liberty knew right away that the listeners would benefit tremendously by using Miracle 2 products. You can enjoy the benefits of Miracle 2 and help Radio Liberty continue to broadcast Dr. Stan's message by calling 800-544-8927 to order your Miracle 2 today. After you've tried Miracle 2 around the house, you'll probably do just what so many others have done: get rid of all those toxic cleaners and chemicals under your sink. Call Radio Liberty and order your Miracle 2 today. 800-544-8927. 800-544-8927. Dr. Stan Monteith and so many listeners know that Miracle 2 soap isn't just soap. It's a miracle.
Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty. Our guest this afternoon is Mr. I.C. Smith. He's a former top G-man, and of course it's a fascinating story of his life, but he lived through a fascinating period of time there, of course, and he really is quite objective in talking about many of the things he experienced. And of course you were there at the time of the siege there at Ruby Ridge. Would you like to talk a little bit about that? Because I think that you, were very, very concerned that, what was going on, and you were concerned about the fire, and of course the attitude in Washington D.C. was, well, the FBI didn't start it, and you were pointing out, yeah, but women and children are going to die in this fire, and the attitude seemed to be, well, so what? I mean, nobody seemed to be so concerned.
When we talk about Waco, And one of the things that happened earlier that day is, well, as I tell the story in the book, is, you know, one of my colleagues stuck his head in the door and said, hey, turn on your TV. And I immediately flipped it to CNN, which I kept on. And there was the picture of the smoke billowing out of this building. And the first thing that struck me was how this flag was at right angles with a mast, you know, the, which indicated a large wind. And they said they were inserting gas into the building. And I'm thinking, I said, well, you know, it goes back to my days of dealing with, you know, police officers and the FBI, is that one of the things you have to take into consideration if you're going to insert gas into a building is how much wind is blowing. And all of this happening in this particular case is the wind was fanning the flames that had started, probably because of the pyrotechnics of the gas. And then this fellow said, well, they'll start coming out. And I told him, I said, no, these people aren't going to come out because they aren't hostages. And this is one of the great mistakes that was made, is that, you know, we have hostage negotiators. And, of course, by this time in the FBI, the shooters had gotten more control than the hostage negotiators in these tactical-type solutions. And as a, you know, when you as a hostage taker, hostages actually are stressful on a hostage taker. But these people weren't hostages; they were actually a source of strength for David Koresh. And I felt very confident that they weren't going to be running out of there. I felt sure that they were probably inside there as a group praying or doing something like this. And later that evening, when I go downstairs and I bump into this colleague of mine, and he, you know, said, you know, is this going to be a problem? He says, no, you know, we didn't start to fire anything like that. And I can recall just blurting out, my God, Mike, you got women and children that are dying in this thing. How can you say this is not going to be a problem? And I just found that unfathomable, that you had people in that position that just did not recognize the what had occurred. You know, this is something that's going to haunt the FBI for generations.
And I really think it should. And the thing was that nobody was ever punished for what happened. You talked about the hotshot attitude, and I think that was the term you used. And these FBI agents getting a chance to drive tanks and run over automobiles, and of course now the whole a discipline broke down, and they're not in uniform, and they just seem to relish the idea of this attack.
Well, you're absolutely right, and this is not a big thing, but it's an indication of perhaps bigger things, is that when our people were holding the briefings for the press, well, you know, the FBI is always, at least in the past, you took a great deal of pride on the way you dressed and your demeanor and stuff like this, and these guys were showing up there with blue jeans on and pullover shirts and what have you. Well, it wouldn't have taken for a few minutes to put on a coat and tie and, you know, add that professional air to this thing. And that's a small thing, but it's an indication of how discipline began to slip in that whole operation.
And, of course, I think you make the point very well, you know, that the FBI had always been something you'd been very proud of, and of course, it had the highest of standards. And here you begin to see this whole system breaking down, and almost a countless disregard for the deaths of the women and children who were there.
Well, I think that's the case. I was just taken aback that there didn't seem to be anyone just grasped the enormity of what had just occurred, and perhaps because I was somewhat at arm's length from the operation that allowed me to do that. But I can also tell you that I don't really talk about this so much in the book, but some of the people who had tactical experience, that who were not involved in the thing, they were just shaking their heads at the whole process.
And they seem to have always put the wrong people in positions of power, because there are an awful lot of good people in the FBI, and the impression that I got, you know, you love the FBI, you thought there were good people there, and of course they seem to put the wrong people into positions of power. But the problem, and I think that bothers many of us, is nobody is ever chastised, nobody's ever fired. It's always cover up, you know, gather around the, circle the wagons, and then, of course, it's us against them.
Well, this is one of the things, and of course, I talk about this as relation to 9/11.
Hold that thought. We'll be back here in just a moment.
Sure.
people laugh at the idea that there is or has been a secret society. I wanted to tell you about a tape we have. It's a talk I gave before the Concerned Women of America some years ago, and it basically goes back into the background behind the secret society, which was formed in England and eventually came to America and came to be known as the Council on Foreign Relations. It goes into the background of Cecil Rhodes. And how does that secret society that he created impact on you today? If you read the works of Professor Carol Quigley, who was Bill Clinton's mentor, you'll understand that Professor Quigley is probably one of the leading experts today on history, but also a man who had the courage to speak out. You need to get the four-tape set, The Secret Government, to understand what Professor Quigley taught Bill Clinton. That's 1-800-5-HIV-WAR, because America is under attack today.
Leading-edge dentists know the profound effect dental materials and procedures have on the health of the entire body. If you've been searching for a holistic trained dentist who can safely treat you, look no further. Dr. David Biles has been a leader in the Santa Cruz dental community for nearly 20 years. He built a solid reputation providing exceptionally high-quality cosmetic and restorative dental care long before learning the very real hazards of common dental practices. Now, as a faculty member of the Institute of Natural Dentistry, Dr. Biles has begun lecturing nationally to other dentists on alternative and complementary dental care. On request, Dr. Biles will safely remove toxic dental materials from your mouth while substituting them with safe, non-allergenic restorations. Call Dr. Biles today and take the next step to improve your health. With sedation and nitrous oxide available, Dr. Biles can help even the most anxious patients. Call 423-0121 and schedule a visit now. That's 423-0121.
Well, this is Dr. Stan here, and I just want to mention we do carry the Big Berkey and the Berkey Life water filters, and certainly if you're in an area where there's any fluoride in the water or arsenic or lead, and you know, you probably most people don't know, but when they put the fluoride in, they also put in arsenic, lead, cadmium, and polonium 20, I believe it is. It's a radioactive material. There are no EPA studies, there are no scientific studies that show it's safe, but don't you feel bad. The government is putting it there because, well, they want, of course, to help children. Teeth. The only trouble is the studies show it doesn't work. Or do they have another agenda behind that? Well, you need to get my November newsletter, and we'll send it to you free of charge. Ask for the November newsletter about the toxic effects of fluoride on fertility, on the mind, on the thyroid, on the endocrine system, on bones. Call us at 1-800-544-8927 and ask for a copy of the November newsletter. And, of course, consider very seriously getting either a Big Berkey or a Berkey Light to get the fluoride out of your water. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is a fascinating book. I've enjoyed reading it very much. It's called Inside: A Top G-Man Exposes Spies, Lies, and Bureaucratic Bungling Inside the FBI. It's by Mr. I.G. Smith, and of course it's published by, Thomas Nelson that...
And Nelson Current, this is a new imprint. They have, for years have been one of the large publishers doing a lot of religious-related publications and things of this nature, and they kind of wanted to get into the first-person things, current events and what have you, and actually mine is the second book that was published under Nelson Current.
All right, fine. Well, anyway, they did. It's a subdivision of Thomas Nelson. It's a great book, and it's Mr. I. C. Smith. Well, you know, of course, then you get into what happened on 9/11, and of course, you start off with this quotation from Louis Free that says, "The facts so far on the public record do not support the conclusion that these tragic events could have been prevented by the FBI and intelligence communities acting alone." And, of course, as I read what you have to say, you are quite critical of some of the things that the FBI did as far as what happened there. Somebody once said, well, you know, my goodness, you know, we got to be right 99 times, you know, but one time we're wrong and then we get criticized and nobody ever remembers the 99 things we got right. And as you point out, but he never mentioned what those 99 things were that they got right. So why don't you tell us your impression of what happened that morning? How was it possible that, you know, 19 people were possibly able to hijack four airplanes and carry out the attack as they did when we have, you know, the most expensive military and interception in the world? And you know, there's something seriously wrong with this story. Or did you have that feeling?
Oh, without question. In fact, when Louis Freeh made that comment, I mean, I was just actually just quite astounded that, that he would even make those that sort of conclusion. The most sacred role of government is to protect its citizens. And regardless of any way that you try to measure this thing, is the government failed the citizens on 9/11. And of course, the FBI is very much a part of that that process at the time. You look at the totality of the information that the FBI had available, and being very candid, and I think I make this comment in the book, I'm not even sure we know yet everything that they know, because I'm not even sure at this point that the FBI knows everything that they had available. But you look at the information that they had out of Phoenix, and then out of Minneapolis, and out of Oklahoma City, and you go back to 1995 and Operation Bojinka out of Manila, where they were talking about flying aircraft into CIA headquarters. I can remember vividly being told about this, and the fellow that was telling me, he was kind of one of the people in charge of terrorism. I told him, I said, "Well, this changes everything." He said, "Well, what do you mean?" I said, "Well, in the past, in the 1993 World Trade Center." And then later on, when they were planning to blow up the tunnels under the river there in New York, I said they were setting the bombs and then they were running. But this is different because now they're talking about going in with the aircraft. And then then there was information from the French are talking about using an aircraft to fly into the Eiffel Tower. So if you take all of this information, and then you add that little tidbits in there that one of these guys wasn't interested in taking off and landed. All he wanted to do was learn how to steer a plane. Well, you know, even a very mediocre analyst would have concluded that, you know, something's amiss about airplanes. And the suggestion that the Phoenix agent had, and I want to make something very clear, Dr. Stan, is that the rank-and-file FBI agents in the field offices, they did their job, and they did it very well. The breakdown was at FBI headquarters. But if they had taken the advice of that agent, they said, let us go out and make contact with these flight schools, I'm absolutely convinced that this would have disrupted that whole operation. You know, even one of the things that a good spy does and a good terrorist is they don't bring attention to themselves. They blend in. And this is actually one of the strengths of Larry Chen in some respects. He was just kind of part of the woodwork. But here they are. I mean, one of the stories that came out of this is the actor James Wood from Out Your Way was on a flight from Boston to Los Angeles, and he was so concerned about a couple of these characters sitting up in first class that he even talked to the flight attendants about it. Well, we almost certain that these guys were making a dry run. But they stood out, and that sort of thing. And so I'm absolutely convinced that the 9/11 attacks could have and should have been prevented. Then, of course, you get into the next issue is no one was ever had to pay a price for their failure.
And of course, you know, ordinarily, if you really did something that bad, I mean, you would be censored or even fired, wouldn't you?
Well, how you say this? I would hope so. But the thing that's so troublesome, and it goes back even perhaps what you were talking about, Ruby Ridge and then Waco, is that there has been a trend developing, and the FBI is not unique in this thing. You know, perhaps in my Navy training, it used to be that if the captain of a ship and if you backed over a buoy or something like that, you probably got relieved within 30 minutes. That's just one of the facts of command. And what actually happens is there's been increasingly a trend to push down blame at the lowest level they could, or just frankly, just not anyone fix responsibility at all. And you know, in fact, if you look at the last lines of my book, that's basically the issue that I take on there, where I talk about this failure to adhere to a fundamental tenet of command, that command has both its rewards and its peril, practically ensures that at some point in the future, terrorists will strike, fingers will point, politicians will posture, and we will revisit the same process again.
And I think you were very, very honest in the book. And of course, there were a number of facts that you brought out. One of them was about John O'Neill. And of course, there had been a great a deal talked about John O'Neill. You knew him pretty well. And he was apparently a very, very smart man, but he was very brisk in his administration. But he was also a womanizer. And when you're courting three or four ladies at the same time and sleeping with them, you know, and if you're going to carry on with that sort of affair, I don't think you're a very moral individual. And nobody seems to be that worried about it. I thought of one time, that they insisted on high moral standards in the FBI, and it seems like those standards are something of a remembrance of things past.
I wasn't a confidant of John O'Neill by any stretch of the imagination, but then I doubt seriously that there was anyone that could make that claim. I certainly didn't know about these multiple affairs that he was having and what have you. He was a man that could be even brilliant. He was a quick study and about to, because he didn't really have a deep background in terrorism and what have you. But he was also a fellow that treated subordinates extraordinarily shabbily, and that's always perhaps an indication of an individual. And he was a guy that I just don't really know how he managed to slip by as long as he did. He certainly had some people that were trying to take care of him, and I think that's part of the problem.
And isn't there an awful lot of favoritism? I mean, you seem to point out that, you know, the reason Robert Mueller got to be head of this FBI is because John Ashcroft wanted him there. And you even use the story that they tell about when Robert Mueller was having a press conference with John Ashcroft standing behind him, and John Ashcroft's lips hardly moved at all. In other words, it was almost like Mueller was the dummy for the ventriloquist.
Well, that was one of the stories. That was, of course, I was gone from the FBI at the time, but this, you know, through the ex-agent groups and stuff like this and the contacts, that was just kind of the tongue-in-cheek story that was going around, that when Ashcroft, when Mueller was given a press conference, you could barely see Ashcroft's lips moving. And that doesn't, you know...
That doesn't get a lot of confidence on the part of the FBI. Well, you got to have respect for the guy who's in charge.
Oh, without question, and like it or not, there has to be a degree of independence from the FBI, from the Attorney General's office, and because who's going to investigate wrongdoing within any administration? I'm not just talking about the Bush administration or something like this. And that's certainly now that there's no longer an independent counsel law, who would investigate wrongdoing by a cabinet member or even maybe Ashcroft himself or one of his subordinates or something like that?
And you need an independent Federal Bureau of Investigation. You don't have it anymore. And I feel that, you know, reading your book, you love the FBI. You really had the greatest respect for it. I love the people who were there. But you see things changing, and not necessarily for the better.
Well, that's right. And one of the great concerns I have is the politicization of not only the FBI but certainly the whole criminal justice system. And this is probably the single greatest concern that I have. You look at terrorism. I mean, you look at the history of terrorism. Is an ebb and flow. And I realize it's terribly difficult for us to imagine this at this time, but, you know, at some point in the future, Al-Qaeda is not going to be a problem for the FBI or this country. Now, probably some other group will. Terrorism itself is pretty constant, but the individual groups come and go. When the last time we heard about the Japanese Red Army or the United Freedom Fighters or some of these other type of groups that have been a real problem for us over the years? And they seem to run out of gas after a while, you might say, to put it in a layman's term. But the politicization of the FBI, this is in the whole criminal justice system, that is something that should be a very grave concern.
And I noticed you spoke about how when Bill Clinton first came into office, the first thing he did was fire every United States attorney. So then you've got to bring in a whole flock of United States attorneys, and you pick people not based upon their dedication to their job. They were political. They were political appointees, and of course, so many of them had so many conflicts of interest. A lot of crimes didn't get actually prosecuted.
Well, absolutely. You know, this was a situation in Arkansas where there's two United States attorneys, and both of them were basically very, very political appointees. I realize I'm not so naive to think that we can have non-political appointees in these positions. But neither one of the United States attorneys there had ever been in a criminal courtroom.
And, of course, you pointed out that Janet Reno, who was appointed Attorney General under Bill Clinton, was actually about the third appointee. Everybody else had so many activities that were improper that they came down to Janet Reno, and she was known for being much more concerned about prosecuting deadbeat dads in Florida than going after the drug dealers.
Oh, absolutely the case, and it's almost... look back at her appointment is after the first two had kind of blown up, is that it's almost like we got to get somebody quick and almost an act of desperation, and she certainly didn't have any nannies in her background, so I guess that's, of course, she didn't have any kids to take care of, anything like that. But of course, I knew her when I was in Miami as assistant special agent in charge, and that was her reputation. She would much rather go after a deadbeat dad or someone she thought was a deadbeat dad than she had a drug dealer.
Well, there's some people think that she hated men, but we won't get into that. Anyway, under circumstances, this is a very objective book, and it's called Inside, A Top G Man Exposes Spies, Lies, and Bureaucratic Bungling Inside the FBI. How can people get copies of your book?
Well, of course, it's the bookstores, Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books A Million, and then, of course... it's my website, actually. I have a website.
Well, why don't we get that out?
Yes, it's www.icsmith.com.
That's icsmith.com.
All one word. And there's actually a couple of links in there that not only tell about the book and a little bit about me and some other media, some other comments I've made. One of the things I've commented quite heavily on is the spy case out in the West Coast there involving the two FBI agents and the Parlamate case. But there's links there not only to be able to buy the book, but also to communicate with me directly. And I will guarantee you that the people that are communicating with me, I answer them all.
Well, I think you give sort of an overview of the FBI during the, about 30 years you were with them?
25 years.
25 years. And you know, the guy is there trying to do a good job and having an opportunity to really be part of history, to have an opportunity to work there the office there in Florida where, of course, you're dealing with the Cuban nationals and working at the national level. And then, of course, as we see what's happening to the country, are you concerned that we've sort of lost our moral foundation?
Oh, there's no doubt about it. It's almost like our, and I'm not a great moralist by any stretch of the imagination, Dr. Stan, but I'd also say one of the things that bothers you that I find that there's this, you know, I was raised by grandparents, and I was always told to tell the truth and take the consequences and this sort of thing, and it's, you know, just do the right thing, and that seems like we've kind of gotten away from that.
Well, I think we really have, but certainly you come through in the book as somebody who really wants to do the right thing. And, of course, most of the people, most of the things that happened to you, you know, were good. And, of course, you had a tremendous impact and you had an opportunity really to witness the unfolding of so many of the events of modern times.
And well, meet some absolutely fascinating people along the way.
And, of course, good things, a lot of bad things. Well, what's the parting thoughts you'd like to leave with our listeners today?
Well, this is a book that is written, and I would say is intimately personal, and it's written with this the extraordinary candor, even if to the point that if at times it reflects unfavorably on me, that's so be it. And I just wanted to write something that could also add a little bit of discourse to some of the historical events that occurred along the way, the Reagan assassination attempt, things like this, that just kind of flesh out some of these things. And I'm not going to satisfy everybody. I certainly didn't write it with that purpose in mind. I just wanted to tell it like it was.
Well, I think you were very, very objective. You were critical of the FBI on occasion, at least the administration of the FBI and the method by which they seem to appoint people, you know, to being the director of the FBI. One of them had been an agent for 6 years, and suddenly he's the director of the FBI.
Had no real management experience anywhere along the way.
And of course, the fellow Rogers, who was in charge at Ruby Ridge and at Waco, had no experience with hostages. hostage crisis. He was put in there because of favoritism, and you can't have an organization that's built upon favoritism. And then, of course, when everything falls apart, why, of course, then they circle the wagons, and nobody's ever punished. And of course, we need to have police officials at every level of our government that we have respect for, that we know will abide by the law, rather than trying to cover themselves. Well, I really want to thank you for being our guest, and I hope maybe I can get you back on some of our other programs. We actually have 3 separate audiences we do every day, so I'll call you off the air and see if we make arrangements to get you on one of the other programs.
Well, Dr. Stan, it's been a real pleasure, and as a colleague of mine told me the other day, he says, you're always a person who, if they didn't want to hear the answer, don't ask you the question.
God bless you. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Well, that was Mr. I.C. Smith. His book,
Insight,
A Top G-Man Exposes Spies, Lies, and Bureaucratic Bungling Inside the FBI. It's a very objective book, and I think you'll enjoy reading it very much. It's available from Amazon.com or Borders or almost any bookstore. We'll be back in just a moment here at Radio Liberty. Have you ever wondered what really happened in Oklahoma City? Well, a very important video is the cover-up in Oklahoma City. It really consists of film clips that were actually taken from video footage shot during the first 2 or 3 days after the bombing. And you'll actually hear the commentators in Oklahoma City talking about the second bomb, the third bomb that had been disarmed. Now, if they were actually disarming bombs there, why didn't we hear that throughout the rest of the country? You'll actually hear an interview with one of the gentlemen who was in the Murrah building at the time that the bomb went off, and he had time then to jump underneath his desk before the glass blew in from outside. Obviously, there were 2 bombs, 1 inside, 1 outside. Call 1-800-5-HIV-WARN. It is vitally important that you help us to get this message out across America, because without knowledge, my people perish. Well, this is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, and of course we want to tell you about a few of the things we carry. Certainly we are going to be carrying the Sanjian radios, and if you need a shortwave radio, you know, if you've got a shortwave radio, why, you can listen to Radio Liberty 4 hours every day. Of course, you won't get much accomplished, but you can listen to us 4 hours every day at shortwave. It's AM, FM, and of course, then if you're on AM or FM, why, of course, sometimes you can get us in your own area, then you could listen to us 5 hours every day. We're 5 hours on the satellite. We're certainly 5 hours on the internet. And what a unique opportunity we have, what a privilege it is, to be able to share ideas with people all across America, and perhaps to get them the information they're not going to get from other sources. So if you'd like to get know more about the Sanjian radio, you can go to our website at radioliberty.com, and you'll see it described there, and hopefully you'll want to get one. But remember, this comes not only a digital radio with FM, AM, shortwave, but it comes with a 25-foot aerial carrying case, and we think it's an excellent shortwave. The key to any shortwave is having a good aerial. We also carry the Robinson Homeschool curriculum. It's on actually 22 CDs, and for $195 or $199, I guess it is. Why, of course, you can take your child from grammar school all the way through high school graduation. Everything's on those CDs. The only separate books you have to buy are the textbooks, the math textbooks, and of course they can be gotten at a special rate from the Dr. Robinson. And then, of course, we also carry the Miracle 2 soap products, and these things help to finance, because we buy time on radio stations all across America. We're almost on 60 outlets, more or less. We're going to be picking up a few new ones here in the near future. And, of course, with your help, we'll continue getting the truth out across America, the truth that you're not going to hear from other sources. Well, this is Dr. Stan back here at Radio Liberty, and this is the time when we have to remind you that Radio Liberty is primarily listener-supported, and we do hope many of you will give a serious consideration to joining the Radio Liberty family of supporters, because that's how we're able to do what we do. 5 hours every day on radio, on the internet, on satellite, and, of course, 4 hours a day on shortwave. And then, of course, if you really want to understand what happened on September 11th, why, of course, we have a book. It's called Inside Job. It's written by Jim Mars, and of course, it very, very good overview of the tragedy of what happened that day. And if you believe what the government is telling you, why, you're sadly mistaken. There's the terrorist timeline. It's the terrorist timeline by Paul Thompson, and this will give you all sorts of information. Did you know, for instance, that one of the terrorists, actually hijackers, turned himself into the FBI and said, I've been trained as a hijacker, and we're going to, of course, hijack your 747s and crash them into your buildings. And what did they do? Did they try to get the rest of the cell that he was part of? Oh, no, they got him out of the country as quickly as possible. Why do you think that happened? Well, there's so much to the story you're not going to get elsewhere. We have a book called The War on Freedom. It was written shortly after the attack, but it's one of the best books available. We have a book called Cover Up. It's written by Dr. Dennis Cuddy. It's got information in it. Did you know that many of the children in the Pakistani area of New York City carried their cameras to school on the morning of September 11th so they could take pictures of the attack on the World Trade Center? Bet you didn't read that in your local newspaper. 911 Prior Knowledge is another book by Dr. Dennis Cuddy. These books are all available from Radio Liberty by calling 1-800-544-8927. That's 1-800-544-8927. Now, why are you not reading this in your newspaper or hearing about this from radio or television? Well, you need to get the book we carry called The New Media Elite. It's written by Professor Ben Bagdaki, and formerly the chairman of the Department of Journalism at the University of California in Berkeley. That's the new media monopoly, and you'll find that five mega corporations that all tie into the establishment dominate the American media. It's a fascinating book. To understand the spiritual component of what's going on, you need to get Craig Pinto's excellent videos, Megiddo, The March to Armageddon. That's Megiddo 1, The March to Armageddon. And of course, it gives you an overview of the spiritual battle going on today, the prophecies, and many, actually, churches will use this for Bible teaching, because it goes into Daniel's prophecy and how it carries forward to today, and then how the First World War and the Second World War, and yes, World War III that we're actually involved in today, fit into this pattern. And that's Megiddo Part 1. It's 2 hours and 20 minutes. And then, of course, Megiddo 2 is actually 3 hours. They're all very, very professionally done. And there, of course, we go through animation from the Garden of Eden right up to what's going on today. And of course, I have a small part in that, as we take you to the Georgia Guidestones and tell you the secret message that's there in 8 different languages. It comes right from the very pit of hell. And, of course, we talk about Madame Blavatsky, who was a Satanist, and, of course, her disciples, who dominate the world we live in today. So that's Megiddo 1, Megiddo 2, and then, of course, we have they sold their souls for rock and roll, and, of course, we have the 3-hour, the 4-hour, or the 8-hour versions of that, and we do hope you'll want to get that. If you have a child or a grandchild, they need to see this. They need to understand the satanic influence of the music that they're listening to. Yes, the music that's even come into many of our churches. So that's they sold their souls for rock and roll, the 3-hour, the 4-hour, the 10-hour version of that. Remember, Radio Liberty does carry the Berkey products, the Big Berkey, the Berkey Light, or the replacement filters. And, of course, you can go to our website at RadioLiberty.com. That's RadioLiberty.com. And please listen to our programs. Tell others about our programs. Pray for America. Pray for revival. Please pray for Radio Liberty, for our provision and protection. Until tomorrow at the same time, may the Lord be with you.